27 to cheerful for 14 women. So I took a long time to just leave the wall. Because it's an insult. Short one is now planning to have a wedding, an official government sanctioned wedding. And all I realize it seems a little funny for us to talk about a man who already has his wife and two children going to get married. But he thinks since he's going to be a pastor of the church that he was really like the government to sanction. He is married to the Lord, for pastor, and vows, so they are married ecclesiastically, but not civilly, which is kind of interesting for us to comprehend. We don't go to the government and ask the government's permission if we can marry. We go to the government basically to fill out an affidavit that we're going to get married. And I would have to say the civil government probably has an interest in marriage. Though in Alabama, you don't go and get a marriage license anymore. You just simply get married. And then once you're married, you go and fill out an affidavit at the clerk of court that you are married, which is it's a little out of the order. Mississippi, you go get the license, but the pastor, once he does the sermon or the service, he fills out an affidavit that he has married. So it's not the government marrying you, it's the pastor who is informing the government, but you get the license ahead of time. Well, anyway, he is planning to marry in August. And so, since he's getting married in August, the certificate to get married from the government, and indeed this is a federal government, whereas we in the U.S. have state government that does it. It's not federal. But they have federal government that does it. So he is getting, since it's in August, he's getting half price on the certificate, and it's 50,000 Kenyan shillings, which equals somewhere around $400. Well, no wonder people don't get married. I mean, I think, if I remember correctly, that I want to say I paid, but now I'm wondering if Paula didn't pay it. But anyway, but we paid, I think, $5. If we had had to pay $400, I still would have done it, but I would have had to borrow some money from somebody when I was 21 years old. So, anyway, so that is where he is, in the process. His house was threatened by the rains, and so he and patients went and carried some sand back to the house and some rocks, and then they bought some cement, and now his floor is cemented, and it's not in danger now of being washed away by the rains. And so we're happy about that. So we need to, and just while I'm talking to you, Barnabas and Ellie, in order to get them a visa to the U.S., they have to have trips off the African continent. I'm not saying this is going to work, but this seems to be the issue, that if you've never left the African continent, that America won't give you a visa. So we're trying to arrange them. They have someone in Dubai, which is the Middle East, which will allow them, so they'll be in Asia, which will allow them to go. So that's a shorter trip, so they're hoping that they can get there. And then we're trying to arrange a trip for them to Portugal to see Tiago. And so that would give them two trips, and then maybe with that they can get a visa. The visa's 5 years, so hopefully they'll be able to get a visa. And we're trying to bring them back here a year from now, roughly. So anyway, if you could make all of that a matter of prayer. There's four churches that are interested in coming, and so that would be something that four churches could help with these issues. All right, I just wanted to give you an update on those. And then, of course, Nico and Roxanne are planning to go to Indonesia, beginning in Thailand, and they're trying to raise funds there. And so we need to pray for Nico and that they will be able to get enough funds to get into it. It'd be good. I would like for us to help them at whatever level we can to help them, because we don't have the presence, the missionary presence that we pay for. In Indonesia, that would be a point of work. They're going through a place a mission enterprise called Timothy 2. And so we need to pray for that. All right, well, I have two questions. I'll take the last one first. John MacArthur said that when someone asks whether it's right for a Christian to say the Pledge of Allegiance to the American flag, his response included that we have a duty to be good citizens and to submit to the authority of our nation, or to submit to those who are in authority, but that we should only promise allegiance or pledge allegiance to God. Okay. So what about pledging allegiance to the flag? Well, I remember even as a child, once I came to an understanding of Christianity, once I came to an understanding of Jesus as Lord, I always remembered even as a child, should we be pledging allegiance to a flag? Well, everybody that I knew, all the Christians that I knew, and when I went to public school beginning in 1960, 60, 61, that's where we learned the Pledge of Allegiance. Well, actually, I might have known it even before that because we did it in Vacation Bible School. And so no one was really, no one ever questioned that, so I never really had any kind of qualm of conscience at all as a Christian to pledge allegiance, though I often wondered, should we pledge allegiance to a flag, but maybe only to Jesus. But anyway, I just kind of dismissed that thought and just did, and I've always done it. I've done it, obviously, through 12 years of elementary and junior high and high school. We didn't do it at LSU. And we've done it at National Days of Prayer. We've done it in Vacation Bible School. I did an investigation a few years ago on the Pledge of Allegiance and from where did it come. And you know, it's been changed over the years. I don't know if you've ever done a study of the Pledge of Allegiance, but it's been changed over the years. Well, it actually began in 1892 was the celebration, the 400th celebration of Columbus discovering America. And so there was a man named Edward Bellamy who decided that we need to have a celebration.
part of that celebration, he decided we need to have a flag project, that we need to give an American flag to every school in America, along with a pledge to that flag. So his brother Francis Bellamy was in charge of what was called the Flag Project in 1892. Before 1892, no American ever pledged allegiance to a flag. They saluted flags, but they never pledged allegiance to any flags. But in 1892, they began this project. Now, Edward Bellamy was a utopianist. He believed, basically, roughly, he was, you know, socialist. And he believed that we ought to, that we would be able to, by human ingenuity, to make our nation and the world a utopia. And of course, obviously that's not true. Francis agreed with him in that regard. Well, so they began to make the flags, began to pass the flags out, and the original Pledge of Allegiance said, you would put your hand over your heart, and then here's the flag, you'd put your hands over your heart, and you would say, I pledge allegiance to my flag. So you would do this to the flag. And to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. And that was the flag. Now they got the whole pledge in order to say one nation, indivisible. Because 1892 was not very far from 1865. You know, 1865 being the end of the Civil War, where the South believed they could secede, and that was never settled by any court or anything. It was just simply settled on the battlefield because Lincoln said, you can't succeed, you can't secede from the Union. And then the war broke out. Well, they obviously were not, didn't agree with the Southern sympathy that you could, that this nation could be divided. That, in other words, you know, the states came in willfully, so they ought to be able to leave willfully. That issue's really never been settled except by that war. So that's part of the reason, in fact, that was the pledge, one nation, indivisible. Now you'll notice that there's a few things left out of that pledge. Okay. Well, after the Nazis rose 1938, and then of course we're in World War II with Germany, that
ended in 1945. You'll remember the Nazi salute. The Nazi salute was this, you see. Well, actually, it was from the old Roman salute, and when the Roman Empire, they saluted like this, you see. Not like this, but like this. Well, after Nazism, so we took away this because it looked too much like this. So then the proper use or the proper stance toward the pledge would be to hold your hand over your heart as a salute and never take it from your heart. And then they also added, and I don't really know the date of this, but then they also added, I pledge allegiance to the flag, instead of my flag, to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Well, you still see that there's something left out. Well, during the Eisenhower administration, and I believe that this was either 1954 or 58, they added another phrase. So then the pledge became, I pledge allegiance, with your hand over your heart, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God. That's seen, isn't it surprising that under God would come in that so late? But I remember watching when I was a child, with liberty and justice for all. When I was a child, I remember watching these shorts that used to be shown at movies, but they were shown on television. We used to watch a guy in Baton Rouge called Buckskin Bill, and Buckskin Bill showed us these, Our Gang, the Little Rascals. Did y'all ever, how many of you have ever seen the Little Rascals? Okay, all right. Well, we got some young people here. I've seen some Little Rascals. But I remember that they were doing a pledge. These things were made in the late 40s or in the 40s, and some of them were maybe even in the early 40s. But anyway, and I remember them giving, there were some Boy Scouts doing the pledge, and they left out under God because it was before, I think it was 1958. So now, as it stands now, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic. Most people don't even understand that we are a republic, but that's interesting. To the republic for which it stands, one nation under God. One nation. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Did I get that right? Anyway, so that's the pledge now. Now, should Christians make that pledge? Well, I think, I mean, if all things being equal, I would probably say Christians should not make that pledge. They shouldn't pledge anything except to the Lordship of Christ. However, we're in an interesting day that there are a lot of people that are not patriotic at all. And for us to begin to question, which I think, you know, we'd have every right to question it, but for us to question it in public would, I think, would send the wrong signal, right? That we are not patriotic, but we are patriotic. In fact, I do think that it is part of, it's really part of our Christian heritage to be patriotic, to love our nation. Now, that doesn't mean that we need to love our government. But, and I think it's kind of a natural response for someone to love where they're from. Okay. I mean, why would I love Louisiana? Okay. Well, I don't think if I was choosing a state, I mean, if I were objective and choosing a state, that I might would choose Louisiana to love. I might would love Florida, or I might would love Texas, maybe Tennessee. You notice I'm staying below the Mason-Dixon here. So I don't know. If I had been born in New Jersey, I would love New Jersey, I guess. or Wisconsin or Maryland or Pennsylvania. Well, that I think it's a common thing for us to kind of love from, you know, from where we were originated, or from where we were born, or where we were born. And so I do have a fondness for Louisiana. But I also always, all my life, had a fondness for Mississippi, because my mother and father both were from Mississippi, and we would visit Mississippi. And I used to tell people when I would go up to Mabin, where we spent more time than we did, is that really my patriotism burns hot when I come to Mississippi. Well, I think that it's reasonable, it is biblical, that we should love our nation, that we should be patriotic. Not that we should excuse everything our nation has done, in the past. Not that our nation has been perfect, because it hasn't, or that we should. America, live, right or wrong. I do think that even as Christians, surely as a pastor, that I should speak truth to power from the Word of God. I would have to say, when I say the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, I would say to you, and I think it's a Christian stance, that I would say to you that it is not the highest allegiance that I'm pledging. My highest allegiance is to God and to Christ. So I would have to believe that here we are in a church. I would have to think that a church is an embassy. That we are an embassy of the kingdom of heaven. So there is some argumentation that the Christian flag, if that is the Christian flag, that was put together by a Methodist preacher. We have accepted it as the Christian flag. I don't think there's ever been any kind of official acknowledgement that that is the Christian flag. But if that is the Christian flag, and this is the kingdom, or an embassy of the kingdom of heaven, should not the Christian flag be in the prominent position, and the American flag in the subordinate position? Well, I'll just throw that out for you to ponder, if that be right. Is it wrong for any Christian to pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America? I would say I don't believe that that is wrong, as long as we know that is not our highest allegiance. We are citizens of the United States of America, but that is a temporal and transient citizenship. Our citizenship in heaven is eternal. And so obviously that's going to be our greatest allegiance. Now the second question is, and kind of similar to this question, is concerning revolution. So the question says, I recently heard a pastor say that no Christian should take part in a revolution, but their duty is to submit to their government. Not only are there circumstances in Scripture or the Scriptures that could consider or could be considered as revolutionary, namely Moses leading Israel out of Egypt, And then, of course, what about the Revolutionary War? Well, this is also, I don't know, have you heard the term Christian nationalism? You know what that means? I mean, people just throw these terms around. Okay, well, I know what nationalism means. Nationalism means that you support your nation above any other nation in the world. Right? So that's historically what nationalism is. So if we support our nation over the nation of Germany, or Japan, or Italy, or our nation above the nation of Great Britain, then we would be considered historically nationalist. Now, what is Christian nationalism? Well, Christian nationalism is the understanding that we as Christians should work to make our nation a Christian nation. Because we actually believe that that our rights come from God. That the Constitution of the United States does not give us rights. And I think our forefathers would surely not argue with this. In fact, they would promote this, because they did, that our Constitution does not give us rights, but that our Constitution recognizes our rights. And of course, the Declaration of Independence states that we have certain, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable, and unalienable means that they're not alien to us. I mean, they are part of what we are. They're not something from the outside, something different. But God gave us these rights, which has not been a controversial statement throughout Christian history, nor has it been a controversial statement in pulpits around the United States of America or around the world, that we have indeed been given rights by God, and that the Constitution of the United States recognizes these rights. For example, if you go to the 10th Amendment of the Constitution, the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, let me see, I've gotten the preamble there, let me see. All right, the 10th Amendment is what I'm looking for. Here's what the 10th Amendment says. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people. All right, so there's certain rights that we as states give to the United States through the Constitution, and we can prohibit the federal government from having certain rights, but they never can prohibit us from having those rights. And so unless it is deliberately spelled out, delegated, then we keep them. So the idea, though the Constitution itself doesn't deal with from where these rights come, there's many political documents in the founding of the United States that does deal with that these come from God. Well, I heard the other day someone on, I think maybe it was on one of the NBCs, whether it, you know, was it NBC or MSNBC or whatever, the woman was talking about Christian nationalists, and here's what she said. Well, these Christian nationalists believe that they don't get their rights from the Constitution. These Christian nationalists believe God gives them these rights. And she was very antagonistic against that. But yet, that's what we are, right? Now, these rights are given to us by God. And God has, this is our time and our place. God has, I mean, we are not here by accident. We're not here by just mere happenstance. But we are here by the decree of God. So what do we, you know, what does that say when it comes to our responsibility as Christians to the United States of America? Now, I'm not comfortable with the word revolution. There were two revolutions in the 18th century, or at least called revolutions. There was the American Revolution of 1776. And then there was the French Revolution of 1789. One of these revolutions was orderly and godly. One of these revolutions was chaotic and ungodly. So the first revolution was the revolution of the United States, when we decided no longer to be governed by Great Britain or by England. Now, how did that start? I mean, what was that about? Who began such a movement, you see? Well, ultimately, we split from England because the Continental Congress, with duly elected delegates from the various colonies, decided that we wanted to be an independent nation not governed by Great Britain. It was not a bunch of rebel rousers getting their guns and going and overthrowing anything. We didn't overthrow anything. We simply, in the United States of America, we simply told Great Britain that we want to be an independent nation, to which they said, "You're not going to be." And so they sent troops, they had troops, to force us to stay under their government. And so the Continental Congress established an army to protect their rights that they believed were given to them by God. That was not, in the technical sense, a revolution. We were not overthrowing a government. We were trying to establish a government. Now, there are some people that misunderstand that, you see. And so they say, well, that we, as Americans, led a revolution, but we really didn't lead a revolution. Now, there was two great works that inform Christian works that inform our war for independence, which I think is a much better term. Because we had a declaration. This is our Declaration of Independence. Well, when we decided that we were going to be independent, then of course they were not going to allow us to. But there was two books that helped us. And ultimately, these two books were picked up later in the 20th century by Francis Schaeffer. But here's the first one was Lex Rex, written by Samuel Rutherford. Now, if you know anything about Latin, lex means law and rex means king. So Rutherford said that the monarch of England was not the ultimate of power, but that the law was king, and that even the king or the monarch of any nation is subject to law. And then also a guy named Gillespie, I think it's Daniel Gillespie, Aaron's rod that budded. Now you'll remember, you say, well, that seems like a strange title. But if you remember the story in the Bible, Aaron's rod that budded, you'll remember that all the tribes of Israel began to complain against Moses. And who is this Moses? Well, instead of Moses fighting for his position that the Lord had given him, Moses went before the Lord and said, look, you know, they are saying, they're questioning my authority. And God says, well, I tell you, here's what you do. You go to them and you tell them that they bring a rod. And so there'll be a rod for each nation or each tribe. There'll be 12 rods. And you leave them overnight, and whichever rod buds, that is the one that the Lord has chosen to lead the nation of Israel. So they did. They came in the next morning. 11 rods were still dry. No buds. The 12th rod, which was Aaron's rod, not only did it have buds, but it had leaves and flowers and immature almonds and whole ripe almonds. So there was no question. They didn't have to have a magnifying glass. There was no question which one God chose. So Gillespie's doing, who chooses? Okay. So this was very important. Now, if you want to read these books, you better block off a little bit of time because they're not very easy to read, but there they are. Now, Francis Schaeffer picks this up, this Lex Rex. He picks it, you know, how then shall we live? I don't know if you've ever read that, but Francis Schaeffer was a very important thinker of the 20th century, following Van Til, his teacher. But again, he picks this up, and Aaron, you know, Lex Rex is the one he references, and he says, you know, that we must obey the law of God, not man. So we as a Christian people have a responsibility of evangelism, right? That we have a responsibility of preaching the gospel. There are those that say, well, that's all you should do then. you should just preach this gospel and whoever gets saved comes into the church. They would say that our responsibility as Christians is just to the church. They have a what I would call a totalitarian view of the church. That is our responsibility, that you bring them into the church. But then immediately you have to say, okay, wait, you know, but does the Bible talk about both Old and New Testament? And evangelically, we take an evangelical look at the Old Testament. We don't just simply go with the Old Testament without understanding we are people of the New Testament. And so the New Testament is explained to us through the Old Testament, you see, because the New Testament is in the Old Testament concealed. The Old Testament's in the New Testament revealed. So we have an evangelical use of these laws. For example, the Ten Commandments. Does the Ten Commandments have anything to do with a Christian? Well, obviously the Ten Commandments have something to do with a Christian, right? And so there's an evangelical use of the Ten Commandments. This is to teach us how we should live. I mean, how could, you know, so how could you live Christianity in this world without being informed by the Word of God of how Christianity should be lived? So when a person becomes a Christian, let's say a man becomes a Christian, does that affect him as a man? Well, obviously it does. Does that affect him as a husband? Does that affect him as a father? Does that have anything to do, will that have anything to do with how he makes a living? Or his responsibility to someone who hires him? Well, obviously it has all these implications, right? So it's more than simply the church. It goes back to self and to family. Well then, what about the other direction? We are Christians in the United States of America, in the state of Mississippi, in the county of Jones, some of us in other counties. Some Lamar, y'all in Lamar? And Lamar? And so some are in Lamar. Okay, counties. So we have a responsibility to counties. We have a responsibility to state. We have responsibility to to the nation. And in fact, the Bible teaches us that we should be subject unto these higher powers. Well, Romans 13 talks about the higher powers. For there's no power but of God. And the powers that be are ordained of God. They are those who have been ordered by God. So if you resist the powers, you resist the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the powers? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is a minister of God to thee for good. Now this is interesting that here is the Apostle Paul writing in the book of Romans, and he's in the Roman Empire, and the Roman Empire is no really friend of men, or of Christians, I should say. They're not really friends of Christians. But he is saying that we shouldn't be about overthrowing these powers, that we ought to be subject unto these powers for good. Well, what about a nation like China that outlaws Christianity? How does Romans 13 relate to the Chinese? Well, surely it does, doesn't it? Well, again, do the Chinese as Christians have any responsibility toward these things? Well, back to us, we do have a God-given opportunity to affect our government. We have a God-given opportunity to change our government. I mean, in the sense, to change those who are governing us. We could actually change the Constitution, too, if we so desired, by the amendment process. God has given us these things. Now, what is our responsibility as Christians to the civil government? To simply obey whatever they say, and even if they start saying that that men and men can marry and that children can be mutilated, are we simply just to be quiet about that? You see, there may have been a day when we could simply, as Democrats or Republicans, because I can tell you this, the first time I registered to vote in Louisiana, I was a Democrat because I never met a Republican until I was an adult. It was all Democrat. You'd go in and pull one big lever. I remember the Democrats were chick roosters. So I don't know why, but in Louisiana, but there'd be one big lever up here, you know, or you could do that, but you crank the one lever, all Democrat. And there'd be about three Republicans over here. Okay, so, but you know, I was kind of like the boy with the box of puppies. My eyes got opened, you see. And so as soon as I could, I became a Republican. Ronald Reagan Republican. Well, there was a day when we could, when it was just a matter of taxes, it's a matter of involvement of the government in certain social issues, or, you know, where we could have legitimate disagreement. Those days are long gone. Those days are long gone. I mean, when you have a party, the Democratic Party, that is standing for the mutilation of children. In fact, I heard the other day that in Scotland, if you misgender someone, they can put you in jail for 5 years. You think that we as Christians have anything to say about things like that? And do you think that I would be a faithful pastor to your interest, to the interests of Christ in the world, if I simply ignored these things, said, well, just don't worry about it. Let's just live our lives, and we don't have to make any kind of adjustment to the world. The Great Commission is given to us in terms of nations. Disciple the nations. Well, surely we must start with this nation. Now, I realize that there are many different denominations, many different ideas. Even theologians have different ideas about what the Bible teaches and those kind of things. I realize that it won't be just a snap. I mean, they surely, you know, won't just let one or two. Well, it'll be a process, and it'll be a hard work and much study and energy and information, you see. But we'll never get there until we make the first understanding. Do we, as Christians, have an obligation to make our nation a Christian nation? Now, the easy answer is to say no. Because then you don't have to work. No's always easy. You don't have to worry, you don't have to study, you don't have to, right? You don't have to be bothered. Yes is always the harder question. It takes energy and effort and ingenuity and education to do the yes. Now, lest you think that this is just Brother Carey popping off, I want to take you to the Baptist Faith and Message, which is our statement of faith as Southern Baptists. And here's what it says. All Christians are under obligation to seek to make the will of Christ supreme in our own lives and in human society. Means and methods used for the improvement of society and the establishment of righteousness among men can be truly and permanently helpful only when they are rooted in the regeneration of the individual by the saving grace of God in Jesus Christ. Amen. In other words, we believe we have an obligation to bring society under the sway of the principles of righteousness and truth. We are under obligation to make the will of Christ supreme in society, but we don't think that'll happen through party or policy, but ultimately through the regeneration. See, and so R.J. Rushdoony, who's been maligned by lots of people, but R.J. Rushdoony put it like this: this will not happen by revolution, but by regeneration. It won't happen by coercion, but by conversion. Okay, so we're not coercing anyone, nor are we leading a revolution, but we are doing what the Lord has taught us to do. In the spirit of Christ, Christians should oppose racism, which I'm really sorry they put that word in here because there's only one race. But anyway, whatever. I guess they're going by the modern understanding of racism. Yes. How can a Christian be a racist? How can somebody that believes in the total depravity of man, all men, how can we be racist? How can we think that our ethnicity is greater than anyone else's ethnicity when we are all sons of Adam and all totally depraved? In fact, I would say that one of the greatest steps toward ethnic healing, or to modern vernacular, over racism is a Calvinistic view of the nature of man. And so, again, surely we should always oppose any effort to say that our ethnicity is better than anyone else's, or to mistreat someone because they have a different ethnicity, or to not allow them to have the rights that all Americans should have because they happen to have black skin or dark skin or brown skin or whatever, or white skin. We should oppose racism, every form of greed, selfishness, and vice. Vice, that would be gambling, wouldn't it? Wouldn't that be lotteries? Wouldn't that be prostitution? Vice and all forms of sexual immorality. So that means we should oppose homosexuality. In fact, it says that. In all forms of sexual immorality, including adultery, homosexuality, and pornography. Because I don't know, adultery, homosexuality, I don't really think pornography, I think there should have been another statement about pornography, but anyway, sexual immorality, surely pornography is sexual immorality. We should work to provide for the orphaned, the needy, the abused, the aged. I used to didn't read that with as much zeal as I read it now, since I'm old. The aged, the helpless, and the sick. Who started hospitals in the United States of America? Who started hospitals, especially in the South? Who started the hospitals in Jackson? Methodists started one, Baptists started one. They were Christians. In Baton Rouge, Louisiana, the Catholic hospital was Our Lady of the Lake. The Baptist hospital was the Baton Rouge General. The Baptists got out of the hospital business when the government got in, but we shouldn't have allowed the government to get in that, because the government has no compassion. It's incapable of being compassionate because it has no humanity. So we should work to provide for the orphan, the needy, the abused, the aged, the helpless, the sick. We should speak on behalf of the unborn. And of course, you know what the Democrats are going to try to do in 2024. They're going to try to get an abortion, some kind of abortion decision on every ballot, so women, as they suppose, will go out and protect their rights for abortion, and so they'll show up to the polls and they'll vote for Biden. And so I'm beginning to see some people from our side, their knees begin to buckle a little bit, they begin to waffle on, well, should we really take a hard stand on that? Should we? Well, of course we should. And contend for the sanctity of all human life from conception to natural death, so we're not for euthanasia. Every Christian should seek to bring industry, so that means we have an economic interest, government, and this should be civil government, and society as a whole under the sway of the principles of righteousness, truth, and brotherly love. In order to promote these ends, Christians should be ready to work with all men of goodwill in any good cause. So the term here is co-belligerent. We ought to be co-belligerent with those who are standing for good and right causes, even though they may not be Christian or may not be Baptist, or they may not be Republican, or they may not be Democrat, or whatever. With all men of goodwill and any good cause, always being careful to act in the spirit of love without compromising their loyalty to Christ and his truth. Now, do you think that the Baptist Faith and Message is saying to us that we, yes, indeed, ought to be Christian nationalists? That we ought to understand that God has put us in this place at this time. It's not a good time, it's not an easy time. But it's our time. So what are we going to do? I can tell you what most of the church is going to do. It's going to have its concerts and its circuses. And I'll quote Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones singing, "The world is going to hell, and we are singing." Well, this is not easy. And I know why a lot of people want to run from this. And then you're going to have the pietists and the mystics who are going to simply say, the pietists, that Christianity is simply something that is about the individual, and it really has nothing to say to the government. But they are wrong. Should not the United States of America or Mississippi or Jones County be a better place because we have Christians in it? So basically, there's some steps to this. I don't have time to outline them, but the first step, I would think, is that we should expect no favors from civil government, and we should take none, that we should begin to live our faith, and we should teach our children our faith by the educational process we give them, and that we train them to be able to go into the world armed with truth, with the gospel, with the Spirit, and through persuasion and through example, we should lead the world. Let's pray.